face. "Well, what am I supposed to do?" she said, furious. Oh, she was furious, and if her teeth had been chattering before, she now felt sweat rolling down her face. She seemed to be one moist, furious sack of horror. She tasted salt and did not know if these were tears or rivulets of sweat.
"Okay, listen."
The kid took a deep, quick breath. He got up and came over to her, squatting down, putting the gun on the tile floor.
"Any of you move, I'll kill you."
He looked around.
"Just give me a fucking second here."
And then he tugged quickly on both sides of her papery blue robe, tied the white plastic strip in a knot right there on her stomach. His shaved head, with the tiny glints of orange stubble, was close to her. The top of his forehead was still red from where the ski mask had excited the skin.
"Okay," he said.
He took his gun and went back and sat on the toilet. That moment, right there, when he sat back down and she wanted him to look at her, that was a vivid paint spot on her mind. How much she wanted him to look at her right then. And he didn't. In the car, Olive started the engine and pulled out of the parking lot. She drove past a drugstore, the donut shop, a dress shop that had been there forever. Then she drove over the bridge. Farther ahead, if she continued that way, was the cemetery where her father was buried. Last week she had taken lilacs to put on his grave, though she wasn't one who went in especially for decorating graves. Pauline was down there in Portland, and this was the first year that Olive had not accompanied Henry on Memorial Day to plant geraniums at the head of Pauline's grave. There had been a pounding on the bathroom door, locked from the inside by the kid, the way Olive herself had locked it, and the hurried,
"Come on, come on, open up, it's me!"
And then she had seen, Henry couldn't because of where he was sitting, but she had seen, when the kid opened the bathroom door that was being pounded upon, the horrible pig-faced guy with the rifle hit the boy hard, crack him right across the face, shouting,
"You took off your mask, you dumb shit motherfucker!"
Screaming,
"You dumb shit!"
There was an immediate resurgence of the thickening of her limbs. Her eye muscles seemed to thicken. The air got thick. The whole thick, slow feeling of things not being real. Because now they would die. They had been thinking they wouldn't, but they saw again that they would. This was clear in Pigface's panicky voice. The nurse started saying Hail Marys quickly and loudly, and as far as Olive could remember, it was after the nurse had repeated for the umpteenth time, "Blessed is the fruit of thy womb," that Olive said to her,
"God, will you shut up with that crap?"
And Henry said,
"Olive, stop."
Siding with the nurse like that. Olive, stopping at a red light, reaching down to put the bag from the fabric store back up onto the seat next to her, still didn't get it. She didn't get it. No matter how many times she went over it in her mind, she didn't understand why Henry had sided with the nurse like that. Unless it was because the nurse didn't swear. Olive bet that nurse could swear. And Henry, trussed up like a chicken and about to be shot, had been mad at Olive for swearing, or for putting down Pauline earlier when Olive had been trying to save his life. Well, she had said some things about his mother then, after Pigface had screamed at the kid and then disappeared again, and they all knew he'd be back to shoot them in that blurry, thick, awful part when Henry said,
"Olive, stop."
She, Olive, said some things about his mother then. She said,
"You're the one who can't stand these Hail Mary Catholics. Your mother taught you that. Pauline was the only real Christian in the world as far as Pauline was concerned, and her good boy Henry. You two were the only good Christians in the whole goddamn world."
She said things like that. She said,
"Do you know what your mother told people when my father died? That it was a sin. How's that for Christian charity, I ask you?"
The doctor said,
"Stop now. Let's stop this."
but it was like an engine inside Olive had the switch flipped on, and the motor was accelerating. How did you stop such a thing? She said the word Jew. She was crying. Everything was all mixed up, and she said,
"Did it ever occur to you that's why Christopher left? Because he married a Jew and knew his father would be judgmental. Did you ever think of that, Henry?"
In the sudden silence in the room, the kid sitting on the toilet seat, hiding his hit face in his arm, Henry said quietly,
"That's a despicable thing to accuse me of, Olive, and you know it isn't true. He left because from the day your father died, you took over that boy's life. You didn't leave him any room. He couldn't stay married and stay in town, too."
"Shut up," Olive said. "Shut up. Shut up."
The boy stood up, holding that gun, saying,
"Jesus fucking Christ. Oh, fuck, man."
Henry said,
"Oh, no."
And Olive saw that Henry had wet himself. A dark stain grew in his lap and down his trouser leg. The doctor said,
"Let's try and be calm. Let's try and be quiet."
And they could hear the crackling of walkie-talkies out in the hall, the sound of the strong, unexcited speech of people in charge, and the boy started to cry. He cried without trying to hide it, and he held the small gun, still standing up. There was a gesture with his arm, a tentative move, and Olive whispered,
"Oh, don't."
For the rest of Olive's life, she would be certain the boy had thought of turning the gun on himself. But the policemen then were everywhere, covered with dark vests and helmets. When they cut the duct tape from her wrists, her arms and shoulders ached so that she couldn't put her arms down by her sides. Henry was standing on the front deck, looking over the bay. She had thought he would be working in the garden, but there he was, just standing, looking out over the water.
"Henry?"
Her heart was thumping furiously. He turned.
"Hello, Olive. You're back? You were gone longer than I thought you'd be."
"I bumped into Cynthia Bibber, and she wouldn't shut up."
"What's new with Cynthia?"
"Nothing. Not one thing."
She sat down in the canvas deck chair.
"Listen," she said, "I don't remember, but you defended that woman, and I was just trying to help you. I didn't think you'd want to hear that Catholic mumbo-jumbo crap."
He shook his head once, as though he had water in his ear that he was trying to shake out. After a moment, he opened his mouth, then closed it. He turned back to look at the water, and for a long time, neither said anything. Earlier in their marriage, they'd had fights that had made Olive feel sick the way she felt now. But after a certain point in a marriage, you stopped having a certain kind of fight, Olive thought. Because when the years behind you were more than the years in front of you, things were different. She felt the sun's warmth on her arms, although down here under the hill by the water, the air held the hint of nippiness. The bay was sparkling brilliantly in the afternoon sun. A small outboard cut across toward Diamond Cove, its bow riding high, and farther out was a sailboat with a red sail and a white one. There was the sound of the water touching against the rocks. It was almost high tide. A cardinal called from the Norwegian pine, and there was the fragrance of bayberry leaves from the bushes that were soaking up the sun. Slowly, Henry turned and lowered himself onto the wooden bench there, leaning forward, resting his head in his hands.
"Do you know, Ollie?"
he said, looking up, his eyes tired, the skin around them red.
"In all the years we've been married, all the years, I don't believe you've ever once apologized for anything."
She flushed immediately and deeply. She could feel her face burn beneath the sunshine that fell upon it.
"Well, sorry, sorry, sorry," she said,
taking her sunglasses from where they'd been resting on top of her head and putting them back on.
"What exactly are you saying?" she asked. "What in hell ails you? What in hell is this all about? Apologies? Well, I'm sorry then. I am sorry I'm such a hell of a rotten wife."
He shook his head and leaned forward, placing his hand on her knee. You rode along in life a certain way, Olive thought, just like she'd ridden home from Cook's Corner for years, past Taylor's Field, before Christopher's house had even been there. Then his house was there, Christopher was there, and then after a while he wasn't.
This is disc number 5.
You rode along in life a certain way, Olive thought, just like she'd ridden home from Cook's Corner for years, past Taylor's Field, before Christopher's house had even been there. Then his house was there, Christopher was there, and then after a while he wasn't. Different road, and you had to get used to that. But the mind or the heart, she didn't know which one it was, but it was slower these days, not catching up. And she felt like a big fat field mouse scrambling to get up on a ball that was right in front of her, turning faster and faster, and she couldn't get her scratchy, frantic limbs up onto it.
"Olive, we were scared that night."
He gave her knee a faint squeeze.
"We were both scared. In a situation most people in a whole lifetime are never in. We said things, and we'll get over them in time."
But he stood up and turned and looked out over the water, and Olive thought he had to turn away because he knew what he said wasn't true. They would never get over that night. And it wasn't because they'd been held hostage in a bathroom, which Andrea Bibber would think was the crisis. No, they would never get over that night because they had said things that altered how they saw each other. And because she had, ever since then, been weeping from a private faucet inside her, unable to keep her thoughts from the red-haired boy with his blemished, frightened face, as in love with him as any schoolgirl, picturing him at his sedulous afternoon work in the prison garden, ready to make him a gardening smock, as the prison liaison had told her she could do, with the fabric she bought at Sofro today. Unable to help herself, as Karen Newton must have been with her man from Midcoast Power. Poor pining Karen, who had produced a child who'd said, "Just because you're my grandmother doesn't mean I have to love you, you know." Winter Concert. In the dark of the car, his wife Jane sat with her nice black coat buttoned up all the way. The coat they'd bought together last year, going through all those stores. Hard work. They'd get thirsty and end up having a sundae at the place on Water Street, the sullen young waitress always giving their senior discount, even though they never asked. They had joked about that, how the girl had no idea as she plunked down their mugs of coffee that her own arm would someday be sprinkled with age spots, or that cups of coffee had to be planned since blood pressure medicine made you whittle so much, that life picked up speed, and then most of it was gone. Made you breathless, really.
"Oh, this is fun,"
his wife said now, gazing through the night at all the houses they passed, lit up with different Christmas lights, and it made Bob Holton smile as he drove, his wife contented, her hands folded on her lap.
"All these lives," she said, "all the stories we never know."
And he smiled further, reaching to touch her mittened hand, because he had known she might be thinking that. Her small gold earring caught the light from a street lamp as she turned her head.
"Remember on our honeymoon," she asked, "when you wanted me to care about those old Mayan ruins the way you did? and all I wanted to know was which people on the bus had pom-poms on their shower curtains back home. And we had that fight, because deep down you were scared you'd married a dull thing. Pleasant, but dull. He said no, he didn't remember that at all, and she sighed deeply to let him know she thought he did, pointing then to a house on the corner, done all in blue lights, strings of blue lights up and down the whole front of it, turning her head to keep looking as the car moved past. He said,
"I'm mental, Janie."
"Very mental," she agreed. "You have the tickets?" He nodded. "Funny to have tickets in order to get into a church." In fact, it made sense to move the concert into St. Catherine's after this latest storm had caused the roof of Macklin Music Hall to cave in. No one had been hurt, but it made Bob Holton shudder. He had an image of sitting in the plush red seats, he and Jane, and the roof falling in, the two of them suffocating, their life together ending in that horrible way. He was prone to that sort of thinking these days. He had even had a sense of foreboding coming out tonight, but it wasn't something he'd say. And she loved seeing all these lights. And she was happy right now, it was true. Jane Holton, shifting slightly inside her nice black coat, was thinking that, after all, life was a gift. That one of those things about getting older was knowing that so many moments weren't just moments, they were gifts. And how nice, really, that people should celebrate with such earnestness this time of year. No matter what people's lives might hold, some of these houses they were passing would have to hold some woeful tribulations, Janie knew. Still and all, people were compelled to celebrate because they knew somehow, in their different ways, that life was a thing to celebrate. He put the blinker on, pulled out onto the avenue. "Well, that was nice," she said, sitting back. They had fun together these days, they really did. It was as if marriage had been a long, complicated meal, and now there was this lovely dessert. Downtown, the cars moved slowly on Main Street, passing by street lamps that had large wreaths hung on their poles, and shop windows and restaurants that were lit up. Just past the movie theater, Bob saw a parking spot next to the curb and pulled the car over. It took some time. He had to work hard to ease in between the others. Someone from behind them honked with annoyance. "Oh, fooey to you!" Jane made a face through the dark. He straightened the wheels, turned the engine off.
"Wait there, Janie, till I come around."
They weren't young anymore, this was the thing. They kept telling each other as though they couldn't believe it, but they had each of them in this last year suffered a mild heart attack. Hers first, feeling, she said, as though she had eaten too many of the grilled onions at dinner that night. And then his, months later, not feeling like that at all, more like someone had sat hard on his chest, but with his jaw aching the same way Jane's had. They felt okay now, but she was 72 and he was 75, and unless a roof fell down on them both together, one would, presumably, be living without the other at some point in time. Shop windows twinkled with Christmas lights, and the air smelled like snow. He took Jane's arm, and they walked down the street, where restaurant windows displayed different arrangements of holly or wreaths, and some window panes had their corners spray-painted white. "The Lydias," Jane said. "Wave, honey."
"Where?"
"Just wave, honey, over there."
"There's no point in my waving if I don't see who I'm waving to."
"The Lydias, right there in the steakhouse. Ages since we've seen them." Jane was waving cheerfully, excessively. He saw the couple through the window now, on either side of a white tablecloth, and he waved too. Mrs. Lydia was motioning for them to come in. Bob Holton put his arm through Jane's.
"I don't want to,"
he said, waving his other hand at the Lydias. Jane waved more, shook her head, gestured, mouthing each word with exaggeration. "We'll see you later. At the concert?
Nodding, more waving. They were on their way.
She looks good, Jane said. I'm kind of surprised how good she looks. She must have colored her hair.
Did you want to go in?
No, said Jane. I want to look in store windows. It's nice out here, not too cold.
Now fill me in, he said, as they continued walking, thinking of the Lydias, whose name was not actually Lydia, but Granger,
Alan and Donna Granger. The daughter, Lydia Granger, had been friends with the middle Holton girl, and Patty Granger had been friends with the youngest Holton girl. Bob and Jane referred to the parents of their daughter's friends, even now, by the children's names.
Lydia's been divorced a few years now. The guy bit her. That part's supposed to be a secret, I think.
Bit her or beat her?
Bit.
Jane snapped her teeth together twice.
You know, Chump Chump. He was a veterinarian, I think.
Did he bite the kids, too?
I don't believe he bit the children. Two children. One of them is hyperactive. Can't concentrate, whatever it is these days when a kid can't sit still. The Lydias won't mention it, so don't bring it up. The woman with the pink hair in the library told me all this. Let's go. I want to be able to sit on an aisle.
Ever since her heart attack, Jane had been worried about dying in public. She had had her attack in the kitchen of her home, but the idea that she might fall over in front of people made her very anxious. Years ago, she had witnessed such a thing, a man dead on the sidewalk. The medics had ripped his shirt open, and it could still make her cry if she thought about it hard enough. The tender unknowingness, the goneness of his flung wide arms, his belly showing. Poor darling thing, she had thought, to be lying there dead.
And I want to sit toward the back, her husband said.
She nodded. His bowels weren't what they used to be. Sometimes he had to leave a place in a hurry. The church was dark and cold, almost empty. They handed over their tickets and were given programs, which they held with a tentativeness while they walked into one of the back pews, settling in, unbuttoning their coats, but leaving them on.
Keep an eye out for the Lydias, Jane said, turning her head.
He held her hand, picked nervously at her fingertips.
Was it Lydia who slept over every weekend for a while there, or was that her sister?
Bob asked, while Jane craned her neck back, looking up at the ceiling of the church, the large dark rafters.
That was Patty, her sister. Not as nice a girl as Lydia.
Jane leaned in closer toward her husband and whispered,
Lydia had an abortion in high school, you know.
I know. I remember.
You do?
Jane looked at her husband, surprised.
Sure, Bob said. You told me she used to come to your office with cramps. She came in once and cried for 2 days.
That's right, said Jane, warmer now inside her coat. Poor thing. I suspected it right then, frankly. And pretty soon after that, Becky told me it was true. I'm really surprised you remember that.
She chewed her lip pensively, rocked her foot up and down a few times.
What? Bob said. You thought I never listened? I listened, Janie.
But she waved a hand and sighed and settled herself against the back of the pew before she said musingly,
I liked working there.
And she had. She had liked especially the adolescent girls, the young, bumbling, oily-skinned, scared girls that talked too loud or snapped their gum ferociously or slunk through the corridor with their heads down. She'd loved them, really, and they knew it. They would come to her office with their terrible cramps, lying on the couch, gray-faced and dry-lipped with pain.
My father says it's all in my head,
more than one girl had said, and oh, it broke her heart. What a lonely thing to be a young girl. She would let them stay sometimes all afternoon. The church was slowly beginning to fill up. Olive Kittredge walked in, tall and broad-shouldered in a navy blue coat, her husband behind her. Henry Kittredge touched his wife's arm, indicating they take a seat in a pew nearby, but Olive shook her head, and they sat instead two pews closer to the front of the church.
"I don't know how he can stand her,"
Bob murmured to Jane. They watched the Kittredges settle into their pew, Olive shaking off her coat, then placing it back on her shoulders, Henry helping her. Olive Kittredge had taught math at the school Jane had worked at. Very seldom had the two women spoken at length. Olive had a way about her that was absolutely without apology, and Jane had kept her distance. In response to Bob's remark now, Jane merely shrugged. Turning her head, she saw the Lydias going up the back steps to the balcony. "Oh, there they are," she said to Bob. "Such a long time since we've seen them." "She looks pretty good," he squeezed her hand and whispered.
"So do you."
The members of the orchestra came out in their black clothes and took their seats up front by the pulpit. Music stands were adjusted, legs set at an angle, chins tilted, bows picked up, and then the disharmonious sound of an orchestra warming up. It bothered Jane that she knew something about Lydia Granger that Mrs. Lydia might not even now know. It felt indecent, invasive, but people ended up knowing things. When you were a school nurse or a pink-haired librarian, you ended up knowing who married alcoholics, whose kids had attention deficit disorder. That's what it was. Who threw dishes? Who slept on the couch? She didn't want to think there were people in this church right now who knew things about her children that she didn't know herself. She ducked her head toward Bob and said, "I hope there aren't people in this church right now who know things about my kids that I don't know." The music started, and he winked one eye at her slowly, reassuringly. During Debussy, he fell asleep, his arms folded across his chest. Glancing at her husband, her heart swelled with the music, with love for him, this man next to her, this old man, who had been followed through life by his own childhood troubles, a mother always, always mad at him. In his face right now, she felt she could see the little boy, furtive, forever scared. Even sleeping here at this very moment, there was a tautness of anxiety on his face. A gift, she thought again, placing her mittened hand lightly on his leg. A gift to be able to know someone for so many years. Mrs. Lydia had had her eyes done. They stared out of her head like a 16-year-old's. "You look wonderful," Jane told her, although close up the effect was frightening. "Just wonderful," she repeated, because it must have been scary having someone take a scalpel so close to your eyes. "How's Lydia?" Jane asked. "And the others?"
"Lydia's getting married again," Mrs. Lydia said, moving aside to let someone get by. "We're happy about it."
Her husband, squatty, round-shouldered, rolled his eyes and jiggled the change in his pocket.
"Gets expensive,"
he said, and his wife, a red felt hat tucked over her gold hair, gave him a fleeting look, which he seemed to ignore.
"All those damn psychiatrist bills,"
he added, saying this to Bob with a kind of man-to-man laugh.
"Sure," Bob said affably.
"But tell us, what are your bunny rabbits up to?"
Mrs. Lydia's lipstick was dark, perfectly lined on her lips. And so Jane recited the ages of their grandchildren, described the jobs held by her sons-in-law, the girl they were hoping Tim would marry soon. And because the Lydias only nodded at all this, without even saying how nice, Jane felt compelled to go on, to fill the space between their close, almost hovering faces.
"Tim went skydiving this year," she said, and told them how this had scared her to death.
It seemed he'd gotten over it after a few times. He hadn't mentioned it again. "But honestly," Jane said, shivering, hugging her black coat close, "jumping out of a plane, can you imagine?" She herself could imagine it only too well, and it made her heart race.
Not really a risk-taker, are you, Jane?
Mrs. Lydia was looking at her with those new eyes. Unnerving to have a 16-year-old's eyes looking at you from an old woman's head.
No,
said Jane, but she felt indistinctly that she had been insulted, and when Bob's arm came up to touch her elbow, she felt he had received this for her in that way, too.
You've always been a favorite of mine, Janie Holton,
said the squat, red-faced Mr. Lydia then, abruptly reaching over and rubbing her shoulder through her nice black coat. She felt exhausted suddenly by this silliness. What were you supposed to say when a squat, homely little man whose path you had crossed briefly for a number of years said you had always been a favorite of his? Do you have any plans to retire soon, Alan? Is what she pleasantly said.
Never,
the man answered.
I'll retire the day I die.
He laughed, and they laughed with him, and in the quick glance he gave to Mrs. Lydia, the way she briefly rolled her brand-new eyes, Jane Holton realized that he did not want to be home all day with his wife, that his wife did not want him there either. Mrs. Lydia said to Bob,
You've retired now since we last saw you. Wasn't it funny meeting you in the Miami airport the way we did? It's a small world, Mrs. Lydia added, tugging on her ear with a gloved hand, glancing at Jane and then turning her head, looking up the balcony stairs.
Bob stepped to the side, ready to go back into the church.
When was this? Jane said. Miami?
Couple years ago. We visited those friends we told you about.
Mr. Lydia nodded at Bob.
In their little gated community. That's not my dish of ice cream, I can tell you.
He shook his head, then squinted up at Bob.
Doesn't it make you crazy to be home all day? Love it,
Bob said firmly.
I love it.
We do things, Jane added, as though she needed to explain something. What things?
And then Jane hated her. This tall woman with her painted face, the hard eyes staring out from under the red felt hat. She didn't want to tell Mrs. Lydia how every morning she and Bobby, early, first thing, took a walk. How they came back and made coffee and ate their bran cereal and read the paper to each other. How they planned their day, went shopping for her coat, for a special pair of shoes since he had such trouble now with his feet.
We bumped into someone else that trip,
Mr. Lydia said.
The Shepherds. They were at a golf resort north of the city.
Small world,
Mrs. Lydia said again, tugging at her ear with her gloved hand again, not looking at Jane this time, just looking up the stairs at the balcony. Olive Kittredge was moving through the crowd of people. Taller than most, her head was visible as she seemed to say something to her husband, Henry, who nodded, an expression of suppressed mirth on his face.
Better get back in there,
said Bob, nodding toward the inside of the church, touching Jane's elbow.
Come on, said Mrs. Lydia, tapping her husband's sleeve with a program. Let's go. Lovely to see you.
She wiggled her fingers at Jane, then moved up the stairs. Jane squeezed past a group of people standing right in the doorway, and they went back to their pew, her tugging her coat around her, crossing her legs, cold inside their black wool slacks.
He loves her, said Jane with a tone of admonishment. That's how he can stand her.
Mr. Lydia?
No. Henry Kittredge.
Bob didn't answer, and they watched as others came in, took their seats again, the Kittredges among them.
Miami? Jane said to her husband. What was he talking about?
She looked at him. Bob thrust out his lower lip and shrugged to indicate he didn't know.
When were you in Miami?
He must have meant Orlando. Remember when I had that account I was closing down there?
You bumped into the Lydias at the airport in Florida? You never told me that.
I'm sure I did. It was ages ago.
The music took over the church. It took up all the space that wasn't filled with people or coats or pews. It took up all the space in Jane Holton's head. She actually moved her neck back and forth as though to shake off the cumbersome weight of the sound and realized that she had never liked music. It seemed to bring back all the shadows and aches of a lifetime. Let others enjoy it. These people listening so seriously in their fur coats, their red felt hats, their tiresome lives. A pressure on her knee, her husband's hand. She gazed at his hand, spread over her black coat that they had bought together. It was the large hand of an old man, a beautiful hand, with the long fingers and the veins rising across, as familiar almost as her own hand was to her. "Are you all right?" He had put his mouth against her ear, but she thought he had whispered too loudly. She made a circular motion with two fingers, their own sign language from years back. "Let's go," and he nodded. "You all right, Janie?" he asked on the sidewalk, his hand under her elbow.
"Oh, I get tired of that heavy music somehow. Do you mind?"
"No, I'd had enough." In the car, in the darkness and the silence of the car, she felt some knowledge pass between them, and it had been sitting there in church with them, too, like a child pressed between them in the pew, this thing, this presence that had made its way into their evening. She said quietly, "Oh, God."
"What, Janie?"
She shook her head, and he did not ask again. A traffic light up ahead turned yellow. He slowed down, drove slowly. He stopped. Jane blurted out,
"I hate her."
"Who?"
His tone was surprised.
"Olive Kittredge?"
"Of course not Olive Kittredge. Why would I hate her? Donna Granger. I hate her. There's something creepy about her. Smug. Your bunny rabbits? I hate her."
Jane actually stamped a foot against the floor of the car.
"I can't think it's worth all that emotion, Janie. I mean, really, do you?"
asked Bob, and from the corner of her eye, she saw that he didn't turn his head to look at her as he asked this. In the silence that followed, Jane's anger grew. It became immense, swelling like water around them, as if they had suddenly driven over a bridge and into a pond below. Stagnant, cold stuff filled up around them.
She was so busy getting her hair done that she didn't even know her kid was pregnant. Didn't even know it. Still doesn't know it, probably. She still doesn't know that I was the one to comfort the girl years ago. I was the one to worry myself sick.
You were nice to those girls.
That younger sister, though, Patty, she was a nasty thing. I never trusted her, and Tracy shouldn't have either.
What in the world are you talking about?
Tracy was too innocent, you know. Don't you remember that night she had a slumber party and ended up so crushed?
There must have been 100 slumber parties over the years, Jane. No, I don't remember that one.
Patty Granger told Tracy how some other girl didn't like her. Some girl. She really doesn't like you, you know?
Jane was almost ready to cry, recalling this. Her chin tingled.
What are you talking about? You loved Patty.
I fed Patty, Jane answered fiercely. I fed the goddamn girl for years. Those parents were never home, going this place and that, some party here, some evening there, leaving other people to take care of their kids.
Janie, calm down.
Please don't tell me to calm down, she said. Please, don't do that, Bob.
She heard him sigh quietly, could picture in the dark how he rolled his eyes. They drove the rest of the way in silence, passing Christmas lights, twinkling reindeer. Jane looked out the window, her hands jammed into the pockets of her coat. It wasn't until they were through town, out on the final long stretch of Bassing Hill Road, that Jane spoke again, quietly, with genuine confusion in her voice. Bobby, I didn't know you'd ever run into the Lydias at the Orlando airport. I don't think you ever told me that.
You probably forgot. It was a long time ago.
Ahead of them, through the trees, the moon gleamed like a shiny little curved particle in the black sky of the night, and something moved in Jane's water-filled mind. It was the way the Lydia woman had looked at her and then looked away, right before going up the balcony stairs. Purposefully now, Jane made her voice calm, almost conversational. Bobby, she said, please tell me the truth. You did see them at the Miami airport, didn't you? And when he didn't answer, she felt her bowels ache, and an age-old sliver of anguish shuddered deep within her. How tired it made her, that particular familiar pain, a weight that seemed to her to be like a thick, tarnished silver spreading through her. And then it rolled over everything, extinguishing Christmas light street lamps, fresh snow, the loveliness of all things, all gone. Oh, God, she said. I can't believe it, she added. I really can't believe it. Bob pulled the car into the driveway and turned off the engine. They sat.
Janie, he said.
Tell me.
So calm, she even sighed.
Tell me, please, she said. She could hear in the darkness of the car how his breathing was quicker now, and her own was too.
She wanted to say their hearts were too old for this now.
You can't keep doing this to a heart, can't keep on expecting your heart to pull through.
In the dim light that shone from their front porch, his face looked ghastly and ghostly. He must not die right now.
Just tell me,
she said again, kindly. She got breast cancer, Janie. She called me at the office that spring before I retired, and I hadn't heard from her in years. Really, years, Janie.
Okay,
Jane said. She was very unhappy. I felt bad.
He still did not look at her. He stared over the steering wheel.
I don't know. I can tell you I wish she hadn't called. Now he sat back, taking a deep breath. I had to go to Orlando to close down that account, so I told her I'd come see her, and I did. I went down to Miami, and I saw her, and it was awful. It was pathetic. And the next day I flew back from Miami, where I saw the Grangers.
You spent the night with her in Miami?
Jane was shivering now. Her teeth would chatter if she let them. Bob was slumped in his seat. He put his head back on the headrest and closed his eyes. I wanted to drive back to Orlando that night. That's what I'd planned. But it was too late. I didn't feel like I could leave. And then, frankly, it was too late for me to feel I could safely drive back. It was awful, Janie. If you could know how stupid and awful and miserable it was.
So, how much have you spoken with her since then?
I called her once, a few days after I got back, and that was it. I'm telling you the truth.
Is she dead? He shook his head.
I have no idea. I probably would have heard from Scott or Mary, maybe, if she'd died, so I assume she hasn't, but I have no idea.
Do you think about her?
He looked at her pleadingly in the semi-darkness. Jane, I think of you. I care about you, only you. Janie, it was 4 years ago. That's a long time.
No, it isn't. At our age, it's like turning a couple of quick pages. Blip, blip.
She made a hand gesture in the dark, a quick back and forth.
He didn't answer this, but only looked at her with his head still back against the headrest, as though he had fallen out of some tree and lay now unable to sit up, his eyes rolling sideways to look at her with exhaustion and terrible sadness.
All that matters is you, Janie. She doesn't matter to me. Seeing her, it didn't matter to me. I just did it because she wanted me to.
Jane said, but I just don't understand. I mean, at this point in our lives, I just don't understand. Because she wanted you to?
I don't blame you, Janie. It's ridiculous. It was so nothing.
He put a large gloved hand over his face. I have to go in. I'm freezing. She got out of the car and went up the front steps of their home as though she were stumbling, but she didn't stumble. She waited for him to unlock the door and then moved past him into the kitchen, then through the dining room into the living room, where she sat down on the couch. He followed her and turned on the lamp, then sat on the coffee table facing her. For a long time they just sat, and she felt that her heart was broken again. Only now she was old, so it was different. He slipped off his coat.
Can I get you anything?
He asked.
You want some hot chocolate? Tea?
She shook her head.
Take your coat off, though, Janie.
No, she said. I'm cold.
Oh, please, Janie.
He went upstairs and came back down with her favorite sweater, a yellow Angora cardigan. She put the sweater on her lap. He sat down next to her on the couch.
Oh, Janie,
he said,
I've made you so sad.
She let him help her, in a moment, put the sweater on. We're getting old, she said then. One day we're going to die.
Janie.
I'm scared of it, Bobby.
Come to bed now,
he said, but she shook her head. She asked, pulling back from his arm, which had gone around her. Didn't she ever marry?
Oh, no, he said. No, she never married. She's mental, Janie.
After a moment, Jane said, I don't want to talk about her.
I don't either.
Never again.
Never again.
She said, it's that we're running out of time.
No, we're not, Janie. We still have time together. We could still have 20 years together.
When he said that, she felt a deep and sudden pity for him. I need to sit here for just a few more minutes, she said. You go on up to bed.
I'll stay with you.
And so they sat. The lamp from the side table threw a dim and serious light throughout the silent room. She took a deep, quiet breath and thought how she did not envy those young girls in the ice cream shop. Behind the bored eyes of the waitresses handing out sundaes, there loomed, she knew, great earnestness, great desires, and great disappointments. Such confusion lay ahead for them, and, more wearisome, anger. Oh, before they were through, they would blame and blame and blame, and then get tired, too. Next to her, she heard her husband's breathing change. He had drifted into a sudden sleep, his head thrown back against the cushions of the couch, and then she saw him give a start. What is it? She touched his shoulder. Bobby, what were you just dreaming?
Ooh,
he said, raising his head. In the dim light of the living room, he looked like a half-plucked bird, his thin, dry hair sticking out in different angled patches from his head.
The concert hall roof fell in,
he said. She leaned toward him. I'm right here, she said, putting her palm to the side of his face. Because what did they have now, except for each other? And what could you do if it was not even quite that? Tulips. People thought the Larkin couple would move after what happened, but they didn't move. Perhaps they had nowhere to go. Their blinds remained drawn, however, day and night, although sometimes in the dusk of winter, Roger Larkin would be found shoveling his driveway, or in the summer, after the grass got high and sad-looking, you might find him out mowing the lawn. In both cases, he wore a hat far down over his face and never looked up when someone drove by. Louise, there was never any sight of at all. Apparently, she'd been in a hospital down in Boston for a while. The daughter lived near Boston, so that would make sense. But Mary Blackwell, who was an X-ray technician in Portland, said Louise had spent time in the hospital there. What was interesting was that Mary was criticized for reporting this, even though at the time there wasn't a soul in town who wouldn't have chopped off a baby finger for news of any kind. But there was that small outpouring against Mary. With the HIPAA privacy laws these days, she could have lost her job, people said. Remind me never to have shock treatments in Portland, people said. And Cecil Green, who brought hot coffee and donuts to the reporters who hung around the house those days, took a scolding from Olive Kittredge. "What in hell ails you?" Olive demanded over the phone. "Feeding the vultures like that. Good God!" But Cecil was known to be a little slow, and Henry Kittredge asked his wife to leave the fellow alone. How the Larkins got groceries, nobody knew. It was assumed the daughter from Boston must have some hand in getting her parents' food, because once a month or so, there would be a car parked in the driveway with a Massachusetts license plate, and while she was never seen in the local grocery store, perhaps she brought with her her husband, whom nobody in the town of Crosby would recognize anymore, and maybe he did some shopping in Mardenville. Had the Larkins stopped going to visit their son? Nobody knew, and after a while people did not talk too much about it. Sometimes people driving past the house, large and square, painted pale yellow, even turned their heads away, not wanting to be reminded of what could happen to a family that had seemed as pretty and fresh as blueberry pie. It was Henry Kittredge responding in the middle of the night to a police call that the alarm in his pharmacy had gone off. A raccoon had made his way inside, who saw the Larkins pulling out of their driveway, Roger driving, Louise, presumably Louise, for the woman had a scarf around her head and was wearing dark glasses, sitting motionless beside him. It was 2 o'clock in the morning, and that's when Henry understood that this couple came and went under cover of night, that most likely, most certainly, they would drive to Connecticut to visit the son, but they did it with a furtiveness, and he thought perhaps they would always live this way. He told Olive this, and she said, "Yikes," softly. In any event, the Larkins and their home, and whatever their story was inside it, eventually receded so that their house with its drawn shades took on, over time, the nature of one more hillock in the dramatic rise and fall of the coastal landscape. The natural rubber band around people's lives that curiosity stretched for a while had long ago returned to encompass their own particularities. 2, 5, then 7 years passed, and in the case of Olive Kittredge, she found herself positively squeezed to death by an unendurable sense of loneliness. Her son Christopher had married. Olive and Henry had been appalled by the bossiness of their new daughter-in-law, who had grown up in Philadelphia and who expected things like a diamond tennis bracelet for Christmas. What was a tennis bracelet? But Christopher bought her one, and who would send back meals in a restaurant, one time demanding the chef be brought to speak to her. Olive, suffering a seemingly endless menopause, would be washed over with extraordinary waves of heat in the girl's presence. And one time Suzanne said, "There's a soy supplement you could take, Olive, if you don't believe in estrogen replacement." Olive thought, "I believe in minding my own business. That's what I believe in." She said, "I've got to get the tulips in before the ground freezes." "Oh?" asked Suzanne, who had proven to be consistently stupid about flowers. "Do you plant those tulips every year?" "Certainly," said Olive.
I'm sure my mother didn't plant them every year, and we always had some in the back of the house.
I think if you ask your mother, Olive said, you'll find you're mistaken. The bloom of a tulip is already in its bulb, right there. One shot, that's it.
The girl smiled in a way that made Olive want to slap her. At home, Henry said,
don't go telling Suzanne she's mistaken.
Oh, hell, said Olive. I'll tell her anything I want.
But she made some applesauce and took it over to their house. The couple hadn't been married 4 months when Christopher called from work one day.
Now listen, he said. Suzanne and I are moving to California.
For Olive, everything turned upside down. It was as though she'd been thinking, this is a tree and here is a kitchen stove. And it wasn't a tree at all, or a kitchen stove either. When she saw the for sale sign in front of the house she and Henry had built for Christopher, it was as though splinters of wood were shoved into her heart. She wept at times with such noise the dog whimpered and trembled and pushed his cold nose into her arm. She screamed at the dog. She screamed at Henry.
I wish she'd drop dead, Olive said. Just drop dead today.
And Henry didn't admonish her. California? Why all the way across this vast country?
I like sunshine, Suzanne said. New England autumns are fine for about 2 weeks, and then the darkness settles in and...
She smiled, lifting a shoulder. I just don't like it, that's all. You'll come visit us soon. It was hard stuff to swallow. Henry, by then, had retired from the pharmacy, earlier than planned. The rent had skyrocketed and the building was sold for a big chain drugstore to move in, and he often seemed at a loss for how to fill his days. Olive, who had retired from teaching 5 years earlier, kept telling him,
get yourself a schedule and stick to it.
So Henry took a woodworking class at the Extension School in Portland and set up a lathe in the basement, eventually producing 4 uneven, but quite lovely, maple salad bowls. Olive pored over catalogs and ordered 100 tulip bulbs. They joined the American Civil War Society. Henry's great-grandfather had been at Gettysburg, and they had the old pistol in the hutch to prove it. Driving up to Belfast once a month to sit in a circle and hear lectures about battles and heroes and so forth. They found it interesting. It helped. They chatted with other Civil War people, then drove home in the dark, passing the Larkin house where no lights were on. Olive shook her head.
I always thought Louise was a little off, she said.
Louise had been a guidance counselor at the school Olive taught in, and there was something about Louise. She would talk too much and too gaily, and wore all that makeup, and put such a fuss into her clothes.
She got absolutely tipsy at the Christmas parties, Olive said. 1 year, downright drunk. I found her singing Onward Christian Soldiers, sitting on the bleachers in the gym. Honestly, it was disgusting.
Well, said Henry.
Yes, agreed Olive. Well, indeed.
And so they were getting on their feet, Olive and Henry, finding their way in this retirement land, when Christopher telephoned one night to say calmly that he was getting divorced. Henry was on the phone in the bedroom, Olive on the phone in the kitchen. But why, they asked in unison.
She wants to, Christopher said.
But what happened, Christopher? For God's sake, you've only been married a year.
Mom, it's happened, that's all.
Well then, come on home, son, Henry said.
No,
Christopher answered.
I like it out here, and the practice is going well. I have no intention of coming back home.
Henry spent the evening sitting in the living room with his head in his hands.
Come on, snap out of it, Olive said. At least you're not Roger Larkin, for God's sake.
But her hands were trembling, and she went and took everything out of the refrigerator and cleaned the inside and the racks with a sponge that she dipped into a bowl of cool water and baking soda.
Then she put everything back into the refrigerator. Henry was still sitting with his head in his hands. More and more often, Henry sat in the living room with his head in his hands. One day he said with sudden cheerfulness,
"He'll come back. You'll see."
"And what makes you so sure?"
"It's his home, Olive. This coastline is his home."
As though to prove the strength of this geographical pull on their only offspring, they traced their genealogy, driving to Augusta to work in the library there, going to old graveyards miles away. Henry's ancestors went back 8 generations. Olive's went back 10. Her first ancestor had come from Scotland, was indentured for 7 years of labor, and then started out on his own. The Scottish were scrappy and tough, surviving things you'd never dream of. Scalpings, freezing winters with no food, barns burning from a lightning flash, children dying left and right. But they persevered, and Olive would be temporarily lightened in spirit as she read about this. Still, Christopher remained gone.
"Fine,"
he would say when they called him.
"Fine."
But who was he, this stranger living in California?
"No, not right now,"
he said when they wanted to fly out to visit.
"Now isn't a good time."
Olive had trouble sitting still. Instead of a lump in her throat, she felt a lump in her whole body, a persistent ache that seemed to be holding back enough tears to fill the bay seen through the front window. She was flooded with images of Christopher. As a toddler, he had reached to touch a geranium on the windowsill, and she had slapped his hand. But she had loved him. By God, she had loved him. In second grade, he had almost set himself on fire trying to burn his spelling test out back in the woods. But he knew she loved him. People know exactly who loves them and how much. Olive believed this. Why would he not allow his parents to even visit him? What had they done? She could make the bed, do the laundry, feed the dog, but she could not be bothered with any more meals.
"What'll we have for supper?"
Henry would ask, coming upstairs from the basement.
"Strawberries."
Henry would chide her.
"You wouldn't last a day without me, Olive. If I died tomorrow, whatever would become of you?"
"Oh, stop it."
It irritated her, that kind of thing, and it seemed to her that Henry enjoyed irritating her. Sometimes she'd get into the car by herself and go for a drive. It was Henry who bought the groceries now. One day, he brought back with him a bunch of flowers.
"For my wife,"
he said, handing them to her. They were the saddest damn things. Daisies dyed blue among the white and ludicrously pink ones, some of them half dead.
"Put them in that pot,"
Olive said, pointing to an old blue vase. The flowers sat there on the wooden table in the kitchen. Henry came and put his arms around her. It was early autumn and chilly, and his woolen shirt smelled faintly of wood chips and mustiness. She stood, waiting for the hug to end. Then she went outside and planted her tulip bulbs. A week later, just a morning with errands to do, they drove into town, into the parking lot of the big Shop and Save. Olive was going to stay in the car and read the paper while he went in to get the milk and orange juice and a jar of jam.
"Anything else?"
he said those words. Olive shook her head. Henry opened the door, swinging his long legs out, the creak of the opening car door, the back of his plaid jacket, then the bizarre, unnatural motion of him falling right from that position to the ground.
"Henry!"
she shouted. She shouted at him, waiting for the ambulance to come. His mouth moved, and his eyes were open, and one hand kept jerking through the air as though reaching for something beyond her. The tulips bloomed in ridiculous splendor. The mid-afternoon sun hit them in a wide wash of light where they grew on the hill, almost down to the water. From the kitchen window, Olive could see them, yellow, white, pink, bright red. She had planted them at different depths, and they had a lovely unevenness to them. When a breeze bent them slightly, it seemed like an underwater field of something magical, all those colors floating out there, even lying in the bump-out room, the room Henry had added a few years before, with a bay window big enough to have a small bed tucked right under it. She could see the tops of the tulips, the sun hitting the blooms, and sometimes she dozed briefly, listening to the transistor radio she held to her ear whenever she lay down. She got tired this time of day because she was up so early, before the sun. The sky would just be lightening as she got into her car with the dog and drove to the river, where she walked the 3 miles one way and the 3 miles back, as the sun rose over the wide ribbon of water where her ancestors had paddled their canoes from one inlet to another. The walkway had been newly paved, and by the time Olive made her way back, rollerbladers would be passing by, young and ferociously healthy, their spandex thighs pumping past her. She'd drive to Dunkin' Donuts and read the paper and give the dog some donut holes, and then she would drive to the nursing home. Mary Blackwell was working there now. Olive might have said, "Hope you've learned to keep your mouth shut," because Mary looked at her oddly. But Mary Blackwell could go to hell. They all could go to hell. Propped up in his wheelchair, blind, always smiling, Henry was wheeled by Olive to the recreation room over by the piano. She said, "Squeeze my hand if you understand me." But his hand did not squeeze her hand. "Blink," she said, "if you hear me." He smiled straight ahead. In the evening, she went back to spoon the food into his mouth. They let her wheel him into the parking lot one day so the dog could lick his hand. Henry smiled. "Christopher is coming," she told him. When Christopher arrived, Henry still smiled. Christopher had gained weight, and he wore a collared shirt to the nursing home. When he saw his father, he looked at Olive with a face stricken. "Talk to him," Olive directed. "Tell him you're here." She walked away so they could have some privacy, but it wasn't long before Christopher came to find her.
"Where have you been?"
he asked peevishly, but his eyes were red and Olive's heart unfolded.
"Are you eating all right out there in California?" she asked.
"My God, how can you stand this place?"
her son asked.
"I can't," she said. "The smell stays all over you."
She was like some helpless schoolgirl, careful not to let it show. How glad she was to have him there, to not have to go there alone, to have him in the car beside her. But he did not stay the whole week. He said something had come up at work and he had to get back.
"All right, then."
She drove him to the airport with the dog in the back seat. The house was emptier than ever. Even the nursing home seemed changed with Christopher not being there. The next morning, she wheeled Henry over by the piano.
"Christopher will be back soon," she said. "He had some work to finish up, but he's coming back soon. He's crazy about you, Henry. Kept saying what a wonderful father you were."
But her voice started to wobble, and she had to move away, looking out the window at the parking lot. She didn't have a Kleenex and turned to find one. Mary Blackwell stood there.
"What's the matter?" Olive said to her. "Haven't you ever seen an old lady cry before?"
She didn't like to be alone. Even more, she didn't like being with people. It made her skin crawl to sit in Daisy Foster's tiny dining room, sipping tea.
"I went to that damn dopey grief group," she told Daisy. "And they said it was normal to feel angry. God, people are stupid. Why in hell should I feel angry? We all know this stuff is coming. Not many are lucky enough to just drop dead in their sleep."
"People react in their own way, I guess," Daisy said in her nice voice. She didn't have anything except a nice voice, Olive thought, because that's what Daisy was. Nice. To hell with all of it. She said the dog was waiting and left her teacup still full. It was like that. She couldn't stand anyone. She went to the post office every few days, and she couldn't stand that either.
"How are you doing?"
Emily Buck asked her every time, and it annoyed Olive.
Managing?
Olive said, but she hated getting the envelopes, almost all with Henry's name, and the bills. She didn't know what to do with them, didn't even understand some of them, and so much junk mail.
She'd stand by the big gray waste bin, throwing it all away, and sometimes a bill would get tossed in, and she'd have to lean in and fiddle around to find it, all the while aware of Emily watching her from behind the counter. A few cards dribbled in.
I'm sorry, so sad. I'm sorry to hear, she answered each one.
Don't be sorry, she wrote. We all know this stuff is bound to happen. There's not a damn thing to be sorry about.
Only once or twice, fleetingly, did it occur to Olive that she might be out of her head. Christopher called once a week.
What can I do for you, Christopher? She'd ask, meaning, do something for me. Shall I fly out and visit you?
No,
he always said.
I'm doing all right.
The tulips died, the trees turned red, the leaves fell off, the trees were bare, snow came. All these changes she watched from the bump-out room where she lay on her side, clutching her transistor radio, her knees tucked to her chest. The sky was black against the long panes. She could see through.